The Hebrew Order of David is one of our community's oldest and most established global outreach organizations. Join Stan Claff for the next hour as he explores the issues facing the men in the community. The HOD Hour is a fundraising initiative for the HOD. Welcome to the HOD Hour with Stan Claff. This is the HOD Hour with Stan Claff.
And I'm Stan Claff, and welcome to the HOD Hour, the Hebrew Order of David. 115 years of service to the community. And those of you who have got observation skills would have noticed an explosion of butterflies around Gauteng in the area. And so if you've ever seen a butterfly, but it's very poignant that they should appear at this time. And I want to read you, before I tell you why and before I introduce my guest, I want to read you two poems, or actually what I've taken from the poems and put into my own words slightly. So the first is by a South African poet by the name of Retabile Masilo, who wrote a poem exactly about the butterfly we're talking about, which is the brown-veined white butterfly. That's the name of the butterfly. He says, many butterflies today, as many as snowflakes in a blizzard, just showing us how a storm might start. We watch those last butterflies disappear. And the second poem, which comes from a collection of poetry by Pavel Friedman, and I'll tell you about him in a moment, is The Butterfly. The last, the very last, so richly, brightly, dazzlingly yellow. Perhaps if the sun's tears would sing against a white stone. Such a yellow is carried lightly way up high. It went away, I'm sure, because it wished to kiss the world goodbye. Only I never saw another butterfly. That butterfly was the last one. Butterflies don't live in here. Pavel Friedman died in October. Of 1944 in Auschwitz. Tonight we have an honored guest, Rene Pozniak, an educator and March of the Living youth leader. She's worked as a Jewish studies teacher primarily with matric students for many years at King David High School. She probably doesn't want to tell you how many years. She went on a course of the Holocaust and anti-Semitism at Yad Vashem and became totally immersed in these two subjects. After attending several courses after this, she went on the March of the Living in 1994 as a participant. The experience totally altered the course of her life and led to a passion to ensure that this opportunity became a permanent fixture on the South African Jewish calendar. She's now involved in the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center as an education specialist. Welcome, Rene. Also have in the studio Dr. Natalie Solomon.
Thank you.
Who helps me put the guest on the show, who press gangs the guests usually to get on the show. And
I can verify.
But generally, Rene, they're coming here kicking and screaming, but they go out very happy.
Well, let's see.
So welcome, Rene. Welcome, Natalie.
Thank you.
And, Rene, give us just a background, because we want to talk about education, but your passion is, so you've been on many, many trips on the March of the Living. I mean, hundreds or even thousands of kids grew up now, adults, who've been on this with you. Give us a sense of what it's about, and just let's set the scene, and then we'll talk about education.
Thank you. So Stan, as you said, in 1994 was the first time I went as a participant. It was a very poignant year in the sense that I left here as a South African from the old South Africa, and I was coming back to vote in the election in the new South Africa. So it was a very auspicious year for me. And the whole experience changed my life completely. March of the Living is a global organization that is headquartered in New York. It draws from all countries all over the world. There's something like 46 to 50 countries that participate. It was originally established for adolescents, but more and more adults are wanting to come on this. Obviously, survivors are the number one prize to take with us, because it's like taking a little piece of history with you on the bus. But towards the end of the war, when Hitler saw that he was already losing, he became obsessed with just getting rid of as many Jews as he could. And so he gave an order that Jews be marched on what became known as a death march. And what the March of the Living is a symbolic recreation of a death march, but now it's the March of the Living. The message is very profoundly, sorry, Hitler, you didn't succeed. We are here. We will come back year after year stronger than we ever did before to show you that we have survived and we're thriving. So when parents say to me, is this an appropriate experience for adolescents? And we take grade 11s who are about 16, 17. And I say yes, because the focus is on survival rather than on death. And, it's an amazing thing. It's a challenge to teach the Holocaust today, because you're looking at a story that ended over 75 years ago on the other side of the world. And you speak to a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old and they say, well, what's this got to do with me? So how do you make a story like this resonate with a 16 or 17-year-old who's living on the other side of the world, who isn't even, or they think they're not being touched by this? So it's very challenging. So March of the Living, to physically go to a place where all the evidence is there. And even if the evidence has been destroyed, to a large extent, it's a trip into the imagination, because we recreate what was there by reading testimonies, by meeting righteous amongst the nations, by going to sites where there are, you go to the Warsaw Ghetto, there is some remnant of it. The Umschlagplatz is still there. You still can see things. It's very hard to have an experience like this where you actually become a witness to what happened, as opposed to reading it in a textbook or discussing it in the classroom. To actually see the stones and the concrete and the evidence of what happened, you can't possibly leave there unaffected. And I think that today the challenge of getting young people not only to remember and to never forget, but to actually buy into this awesome responsibility that we all have of making sure that this memory stays alive. And I think that's been borne out by this last week, activities around the world marking the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz.
Do you think it's actually beshiert that the butterflies arrived during this week?
Yes, I think, and the poem you read, I think, was from Theresienstadt.
Yes.
So, yes, very, very, because butterflies, I think, represent freedom, because they can fly and they can go. So when there are no butterflies, or the butterflies have been stamped out, that's symbolic of maybe freedom being restricted as well.
So if you're talking about education, which clearly is the way, unfortunately it's the way, but where's the how, and how do we get it going, and how do we as individuals continue that process? Because I think, and I've always said, that education about the Holocaust is lacking, and there's gaps. Huge gaps. And I think even if I look at my school years up until a few years ago, not that many years ago, I don't remember there being discussions about Holocaust. You talked about the war. History was the Second World War. You wrote papers on what Hitler didn't do or did, and how the British Army defeated them. I suppose if you're in America, you worked out how the American Army defeated them and liberated the camps. But how do we, and I heard, and I've heard a lot of it now with survivors talking and coming forward and saying stuff, but they're always asking the same question. How do we continue that education?
So I think this is probably one of the biggest challenges we're facing, because the generation of survivors is dwindling. Those that are still around were children during the Holocaust. So sometimes you're getting a child's view of what happened. Also, a lot of them are not well. So it's a big challenge for organizations like March of the Living, because it's a very important dynamic, having its authenticity to what has happened. So there are lots of discussions about how to go forward after they're not here. I think Spielberg, by putting a lot of the testimony on on discs, you know, has addressed that to a large extent.
Well, he actually asked the questions which we as the previous generations since the war,
yes,
we should have been asking, and we weren't asking. We weren't engaging in those conversations.
But in part, I think that the Holocaust survivors weren't ready to talk, and that there was a period of silence which was about survival and preservation, where they couldn't actually give words to the experience. And there's almost been like this movement towards opening up the stories again with acceptance and with curiosity and less shame.
Do you mean that they weren't prepared to talk, or they weren't asked?
I think that it was probably twofold, that part of trauma is that it's a nonverbal experience that lives in a body that's not able to narrate a coherent story. So they actually couldn't give words.
Did they have the ability to even, were their memories not...
There could have been that part of it was shards of memory rather than a coherent story, but also that there was enormous shame, and that there was a period where they weren't revered, as in fact there's been kind of going back to recreating them as heroes, but at a specific time they were looked at in shame.
Because they survived?
Well, so what's very interesting about what you're saying, and it's absolutely correct, is if you look at Israel, you know, after the war, the survivors had a choice. They had a few choices. Should they stay in a DP camp? Should they try and go back home to a country that did what they did? Should they look for revenge? Should they look for justice? Should they immigrate to another country? And we know that there were a lot that went to Israel. And initially, there's a book written by Tom Segev, it's called The 7 Million. And basically he's saying that when the Holocaust survivors came to Israel, they were, it's as if they were persecuted again. Because the new Israeli that was founding the state of Israel was a chalutz, was a young army wasn't taking no for an answer, fighting for their own country, that they looked at shame. They couldn't understand that 6 million European Jews allowed themselves to be slaughtered that way. And so for a long time, you're absolutely right, there was shame. It is only with the trial of Eichmann in the early 60s that when they needed survivors to come forward to give testimony against Eichmann. And initially nobody came. And then slowly, and Israelis were watching, were listening to this trial on their radios. They used to stand in the streets with their cars running so that they could listen to the testimony of the trial. And slowly but surely one came forward and another came forward, and then there was an avalanche and people started talking. And it's only then that Holocaust survivors in Israel actually got any level of respect. Until then, it was a badge of shame, unfortunately. And I think huge pain. I mean, who wants to continuously open up a wound and talk about it? And now our sense with survivors that we use whenever we can is that there's almost a panic that they need to talk to as many people as they can. They see it almost as their duty to do that.
Because they're getting...
They're getting older and they know.
Towards the end of their lives, they want to be able to to let the next generation know.
Yeah.
And exactly. I suppose there's a bit of guilt in that, and that they didn't. And a lot of the younger generation were not interested.
Unfortunately.
Or the offspring of the survivors.
I think often it was about really surviving other stresses and kind of making a life again, that if you speak to many second generation Holocaust survivors, which would be the children of the original Holocaust survivors, they didn't even know. Many times they're quite shocked to hear stories of things that were incredibly horrific, that they were unaware of. So there was a kind of trying to protect. There was a sense that we focus on life and that we no longer talk about the death, and that there was a need to recreate, and so we couldn't really delve into the trauma. But now we recognize that it's absolutely essential, that the trauma lives on in generations and generations, not only what we call 1G, first generation, that at a genetic level, there's remnants of trauma in 3G. And so, in fact, we have to talk. We have to give it language because we live it in a genetic code.
And the thing is that I think that memories and history fade away. So we have to look for other ways, because it's no good relying on history and relying on the testimonies and the Spielbergs, because that's not getting circulated enough. So we need to find a way to be able to talk about it and bring it in. And I'm hoping that the schools are bringing it into curricula. But it's, isn't it only amongst Jewish people, or is there becoming a broader acceptance around the world of the situation? I mean, we've had other Holocaust type situations and wiping out of whole segments of race and genocides killing off races and trying to still do it to even today in Myanmar and wherever. But we need to latch onto what we have, and we need to promote that in some way. And I don't know how as individuals we do it, and how, or if it's sufficient to have the Yad Vashems, if it's sufficient to have the Holocaust centers, is that sufficient? Or it's like having a website. You've got to find a way to drive the traffic there.
Yeah. So I will tell you something that we can be very proud of here in South Africa, is that 15 hours of Holocaust education is mandatory in this country. There's absolutely no denial of the Holocaust. And
15
kids,
hours in a lifetime?
In school.
15 hours
of Holocaust,
per annum?
No, 15
once.
Hours. So it's a course that gets given, but it's not as though it's being shunned or denied or not addressed. This is more than a lot of countries can say. So in that respect, I'm actually quite proud of them. And it's not just, we run workshops, teacher workshops, to teach them how to teach the Holocaust.
Okay, so I see that in a big way. I just want to tell you a little story about that.
Yeah.
So the HOD, for Hebrew Order of David, we were invited to bring a tour to the center. And Ronnie Silverman was our host. There were a couple of other ladies there, and there were three young kids there, black kids. I don't know how or why they went there or what they went there for. And I just felt that the organizers of the center were actually entertaining us, old people from the Hebrew Order of David, didn't understand why they were there and didn't take the trouble, until one of the ladies that was with us, who happens to be a teacher, took them aside and started talking to them. And it turned out they were very interested in this whole thing. And so they joined the group, and those people started talking to them, and it became a whole different thing. I guess there's a lesson in that, because I don't know where you start. I know where you start with Jewish. You tell people you're Jewish, you know about the Holocaust, you can build on that. But if you're not, and you're bringing other people, how do you send that message?
It's a challenge. I don't know whether you remember the late Ronnie Mink.
Sure.
So Ronnie Mink was my mentor. I worked with him at King David for 23 years. And as soon as apartheid, we had the election in 1994, and about 1995, 1996, him and I tried to go and do Holocaust education in what were traditionally black schools. And it was an absolute failure, because we felt that their own pain of apartheid was still so current.
Oh, definitely.
That they couldn't relate to it being, but now with distance, I'm at the center. We have schools morning, noon and night, plenty of black kids who are incredibly interested, very respectful, listen, ask questions. There's a lot of ignorance, you know, around this. And I think that South Africa is trying hard to address it. I think that Holocaust education is something that is trending in the world. It's the most document of all genocides.
I actually hate that expression.
What?
I'll tell you why.
Trending,
because it means it's going to come to an end.
Oh, okay. Well, I take your point. I certainly am not meaning it in that sense. But I'm saying it's definitely risen in global focus. And there's an understanding that it needs attention and that it's got lessons to learn. I'll tell you that you spoke about me taking the March of the Living, which I've been doing for about 12, 14 years. The actual kid has changed. The method of education has changed. So before, where we would stand in Treblinka or Auschwitz or wherever and give the history and the facts and the figures and the dates, etc., today, with the internet, and they all got their phones with them, Teachers are no longer information givers. They don't need us for information. At a press of a button while you're talking to them, they can get reams of information, more than you could ever give them. The challenge, and it's much harder now to be a teacher, is to extract what it is that they're reading. The lessons from it. Because not everything you read is in a context. Not everything you read is factually correct. You hope it is, but it really isn't. And I think that the challenge now is to extract the lessons and learn from it. And that is where we, even at the center, there is a Jewish narrative to the Holocaust, which all Jews subscribe to, but there are other narratives. You know, during the Holocaust, there were 6 other targeted groups in Germany. Today, it's about othering. It's about othering people, which leads to you making a distinction between us and them and saying they are not part of us. They're not part of our group. They're something else, which then leads to a stereotype. A stereotype really is based on unfounded. It's not factual. It's a stereotype. And then if you start acting on the stereotype, that becomes a prejudice. And I think that that's probably one of the biggest lessons to learn, is that if you are going to allow hate and othering to carry on unchecked, this is where it leads. And that's where I think education needs to focus. How do we extract? In other words, you got to try and create kids who are critical thinkers, not kids. Don't let other people decide for you what to think. Don't let other people decide what kind of society you're going to live in. You need to make your own decision about what kind of person you want to be. And how can you be part of creating a society that is like that?
I also think it's so important that we explore ideas around what is a victim, what is a perpetrator.
Absolutely.
And that in the lessons, it's easy to kind of identify with one group without ever owning one's own role, and to really bring it to life how we all are perpetrators in some way or another. And really trying to understand and really our own levels of prejudice, how we create othering in everyday experience. And I think that's such an important lesson for humanity.
Yes, absolutely.
Do we give too much credence to words like racism, anti-Semitism? And let me explain what I mean by that. It's on the table. It gets discussed. It gets over-discussed. You look at the Labour Party in England, sunk them. Anti-Semitism sunk them. But at the same time, it becomes part of the discussion as if it's not important. It's just part of everyday, another expression like that, another talk about that. It ceases to have the importance or the kind of momentum that it should have. And I think that we tend to, the more you talk about it, tends to be more on the table. And the more you talk about it, it loses its importance. So its value comes down. And I think that's one of the problems that you've got to fight all the time. Like this anti-Semitism and racism and all those words, they're just part of the conversation.
Well, we're also getting very comfortable. Getting very comfortable with those words. They're not really having the impact that they should have.
And I think that is where, and it's easy then, because what happens now is people are looking for outrageous things to say in order to make their point. So they won't just use anti-Semitism or racism as the word. They'll add something to it. So they'll bring jokes about the Holocaust in. They'll bring jokes about racism in, because it's trying to emphasize the point, which they don't have in their everyday vocabulary. That's why people swear, because they can't find the right word. And this becomes part of the discussion. And I think that's one of the things we have to obviate and move away from. Can I just say that this is the Hebrew Order of David. This is the HOD hour. If you want to, Tabo, you've left me without the documents. If you want to be part of the conversation, send us a telegram to 061-895-1019 or SMS us on 3451. We'd love to hear from you. I have a message here from Ben Diner, who said, I was at King David when Ronnie Mink taught, and it was a true privilege to learn about the Holocaust from such a knowledgeable and great man. And it's from Ben Diner, so there you are.
Wonderful, I agree.
So we do have one listener out there.
Hi, Ben.
Can we talk a little bit about the 75th anniversary a little bit about what happened? Can you give us some insights?
So as you know, there were two separate ceremonies. And I want you all to be aware that we had a fantastic ceremony on Monday night here in Johannesburg at the Holocaust and Genocide Center, which was attended by hundreds of people and many, many diplomats, including the German, at the Holocaust Center, including the German diplomat, the Turkish diplomat, Israeli embassy. It really was a very auspicious occasion. And most importantly, we honored a righteous amongst the nations there that night that Yad Vashem had granted to a family, a Dutch family, the grandchildren, because the parents were not alive anymore. So it was very special. So the 75th anniversary this year was commemorated in Israel at Yad Vashem a couple of days earlier, and on the day in Auschwitz itself. So Auschwitz has been doing that for years. This year, first of all, how did we arrive at the 27th of January? To be, the UN made a decision that that was going to be Holocaust Memorial Day. We celebrated on Yom HaShoah, which is in April, like a week after Pesach. And that was because that was the date that the Auschwitz camp was liberated by the Russians. So Israel was at Yad Vashem. It was sponsored by Dr., I think his name is Kaplan, not Kaplan, I'll think of it in Kanter. Dr. Kanter, who is Russian, he's an oligarch, very wealthy guy, and he is the president of the World Jewish Congress of Europe. You then have Ronald Lauder, who is the president of the World Jewish Congress.
Yeah.
And he sponsored it. He is a very close friend of Putin. And there were also, it was very, very well attended by Prince Charles, as you know, Putin was there, the German president was there, on and on and on. But, the Polish president wasn't there, the Lithuanian president wasn't there, and that's, it became quite politicized. The Polish president wanted to speak, and he wasn't allowed to speak, and I think the Lithuanian president, in sympathy with him, didn't come. President Rivlin of Israel was the main, he actually hosted the whole evening. Was very impressive, but I think it was very politicized. Bibi Netanyahu spoke about Iran, etc., etc. That's another debate altogether, which I don't really want to get involved in, but, you know, is there a place for politics or ego when the real focus should be what happened and the survivors? So some survivors weren't allowed into the event because there wasn't space, because there were so many. Whereas the one in Auschwitz, which was hosted by Ronald Lauder, there were over 200 Auschwitz-Birkenau survivors. Ronald Lauder made a wonderful speech, as did most people. There was a wonderful survivor there who spoke particularly to the younger generation. So from a political point of view, I think that the fact that so many, presidents, prime ministers, clergy, kings, etc., attended this was very fortunate for us. These are decent people who I think are showing support for the very obvious rise in anti-Semitism around the world. And I think it's hard to be present at a ceremony like that, representing your country, and then not make an effort to go back home and try and ensure that anti-Semitism is not tolerated in your country.
Well, at least the fact that they are there speaks volumes.
Yes.
And whereas in times past, maybe they wouldn't have attended, or they would have just paid lip service. Here, at least they made the effort, they attended, and they sent high people.
Yes.
And to have people speak like Prince Charles.
He spoke very well, I thought.
And some of the other speakers, I mean, they all had the right thing to say. I think, I do agree with you, I think politicization, but that's inevitable. I mean, and it's also, it's a sign of the times.
Well, I think that sometimes you use an opportunity to...
Oh, well, that's politics.
Yeah, exactly.
But what was interesting is they used the Wall of Death as the place to lay their wreaths, which was incredibly symbolic. Yes. For those people who haven't been to Auschwitz, can you give us a sense of what is Auschwitz like?
So Auschwitz is huge. First of all, Auschwitz was part of a whole complex. If everybody thinks it's just the one camp, there's Auschwitz, that's Auschwitz 1. Then you have Birkenau, which is Auschwitz 2. And then you have Bonner-Monowitz, which is Auschwitz 3. And there was a whole series of subcamps, thousands and thousands of subcamps that made up the complex of Auschwitz.
So, CNN actually said that Auschwitz is a city.
Yeah, pretty much so. It's become the iconic symbol of the Holocaust, and often I think that other camps, even ghettos and concentration camps, sometimes get glossed over. You know, our exhibition, for example, at the Holocaust Center is not Auschwitz-centric at all. It addresses the whole issue, one area. It's not a pretty place. It's huge. There is a lot to see. It's not that there isn't evidence. When you walk to Birkenau, when you get to Birkenau, which is where you see, that's where the huge ceremony takes place on March of the Living, and there are bombed out crematoria, Germans trying to destroy evidence, for example. You get it's kilometers. It's enormous. It is like a city. I agree.
When you get there, your first time that you walk in through the door, what comes over you? What do you feel?
Well, I think seeing in real life that arch that says Arbeit macht frei, it hits you in the stomach.
But even before, enter Auschwitz, there's incredibly strict security.
Yes.
And you're only allowed to bring certain baggage and they check you. And there's something quite strange about that checking experience.
Reverse security.
Yeah. That almost has quite a jarring impact.
Yes, correct.
Then one sees the Arbeit macht frei, and then one hears the story of how it was actually stolen, that sign, and how it had to be returned, which also is a fascinating story.
Is that the original one, or have they remade it?
I think they found it, but
they had to mold it together.
Yes. Scrap metal of it. Can you believe it?
And then the coming into, first of all, it's so packed, which was in one way unbelievable that there's a history and there's a living memory. On the other hand, there's the dark tourism, which when you drive through Poland, you see these cars advertising tours of Auschwitz, which again feels quite jarring.
Well, that's really in one place. You're talking about in Krakow,
yes,
particularly.
Yes.
But when did it start? When was the start of the touring, or has it always been open?
Well, I know March of the Living is about 31, or I think this is year 32 of the March of the Living.
So the other 40 years, what happened to that? Nobody visited? Was it open for visit?
I'm actually not sure.
Probably, but not on the scale that it is today. It caters to millions of visitors every year.
So the March of the Living, now these, you draw people from right around the world. So they come from as far
they
as
come
Australia,
from everywhere.
New Zealand. America, yeah.
Everywhere. They come from Croatia, from Eastern Europe, from Japan, from India, from China. Wherever there are Jews, they come. And I think that
not limited to Jews, though,
anyone. No, not at all. It's not limited to Jews. And I think that there's even an overture now to try and get more non-Jews to come. There's a human lesson. There are lessons for humanity there that are not only for Jews. It's for everybody. So I think there's a huge encouragement that other people come as well. I think that for a South African, because that's really my interest, we come from the tip of Africa. We don't really understand or have a sense of the Jewish world. We get access here. Some Americans come. Some Israelis come. You might get the odd Eastern European. But we don't really.
I thought we were the center of the Jewish world. What are you telling
me?
Well,
that's what South African Jews think. But I think when I take kids there and they're standing, lining up in Auschwitz to start the march, and there are kids speaking every language you could think of. I think that South Africans get a sense for the first time that they're part of something so much bigger than they thought. And it's very important to see that. I think that we focus on Jewish identity. Who are you in this world? How do you view yourself as a Jew? And I suppose how are other people viewing you? Living here on the tip of Africa, we don't get that sense. We just see ourselves all the time. And it's a distortion, really, of what the Jewish world is. So from that point of view, I think it's an unbelievable experience.
One of the messages that came through from a couple of the speakers that I listened to at Auschwitz, and possibly it was also on the one that was held at Yad Vashem, but it kind of said that, you know, we must stand up for ourselves. It was a message that we must stand up and not to... But that flies in the face of the fact that all of these people had problems. They couldn't just stand up for themselves in 1940 or 1941 or 42.
And that's a myth that there wasn't resistance.
It's an absolute myth that.
I know, but the odds were against them. Whereas in today it's easy to say stand up for yourself, but in those days you stand up for yourself. There was a punishment for it.
So I think in a situation like that, what is defined as resistance needs to be redefined. Because we only think of resistance as getting a gun or a grenade or fighting back in a military way. But if that's not available to you, saying the Shema is resistance. Having a Seder in secret, and there's evidence that this happened, that is unbelievable resistance. It's saying that you can take everything from me, but you're not going to take my essence. That is in many cases the only opportunity available. You know, as a victim, what choices do you really have? It's like a choiceless choice.
That's what I'm saying.
You
could stand up for yourself in those ways,
yes.
But it's a different kind of a stance that you're taking today. And saying, you know, with the might of Israel behind you and there's a state and people, there's courts and there's all sorts of other methods of actually fighting it. You can do that. But in those days, there wasn't.
And I think the systematic planning, for me, that's what was overwhelmed me when I went to Auschwitz, that I'd always understood it as horrific. But when you recognize from every single level, it was planned, it was organized, it was inculcated, it's actually a miracle that anybody did survive.
It's just amazing to me. That the part that actually stabs me in the heart is the fact that every name is documented.
Well,
now, that is not mowing down people with a machine gun. That is actually really calculated murder.
Well, very meticulous records were kept by Germans. A lot of what we know, train records, etc., is from the Germans themselves.
Yes, they created the history. That's what they wanted. They wanted to refer to a race which had been.
Exactly. So just about resistance, because it's something that I think is so important, because people do think there wasn't any. If you look at the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, which is probably the most documented of the resistance, they knew, Mordechai Anilevich and his group of youngsters knew, that there's no ways they could win against the Third Reich standing at the gate with their little sticks and stones and an odd smuggled gun, etc., compared to what cannons and tanks and etc. But what they did is, you know, you have military academies that study wars and things like that. Nobody's ever going to study the tactics of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. But if there were academies that studied the human spirit, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising would be up there. Because they knew they weren't going to win, but they did it anyway, and it gave it was an incredible sense for themselves and an incredible example to others, because there were other uprisings in camps after that.
Something that is poignant for me is how people wrote down their stories and hid it in the ground. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, first of all, you had a
official. In Auschwitz, you're talking about?
So you had official, you had the Ringelblum. The Ringelblum was, Onik Shabbat, was an organization, an underground organization of teachers and journalists and people who took it upon themselves to keep good, amazing, detailed records of what was going on in the Warsaw Ghetto. And that's mostly how we know what went on there. And they were hidden in milk cans, and they were hidden. And I think three were found. I think there's still one missing one that they haven't been able to find. There's speculation that it's under the Chinese embassy, and hordes of people go there just because they think that's where it is.
Now while China's having these problems, might be the opportune moment.
Exactly. So, and there were ordinary people. I tell you what I also found amazing that was documented is that Hitler believed that he was going to get rid of all the Jews. And to that end, he started collecting Jewish memorabilia, Gemaras and Talmuds and Torahs and bells and the Yad and all these things. And all this looted stuff was kept in big warehouses.
And well documented.
So that one day...
Catalogued.
One day he was going to create a museum to the extinct Jewish race.
Yes.
Like you go to a dinosaur museum. And if there was, I didn't prepare this, I can't remember his name, there was a rabbi there who happened to be put in charge of this big warehouse. And people in the ghettos, in the camps, came to him to ask him questions. Like, I'm on a slave labor detail. I get woken up before the sun rises. I come back after the sun is set. When can I lay to fill in?
No,
but there were cases of smuggled or made or smuggled. There was hardly anything like that. Very forbidden. Or Pesach is coming now. The only thing we get is a piece of bread. What do you do? And I found this the most fascinating. What he did is he went to the Gemaras and whatever he could find in these warehouses and used it as a direction because there was no precedent for questions like this. And I find it unbelievable that people who are in a life and death situation, starving, emotionally completely finished, would care about when to lay to fill in or when or what do you do on Pesach. And that also is documented, all these questions that were asked.
Well, we had a function in Israel, offices changing, you know, for our office bearers in Israel, because we have lodges in Israel. And at one of the functions was a Holocaust, was an American soldier who lived in Israel. He passed away some time ago, but he was one of the team that liberated the camps. And the thing that he said that on that score, what you're telling us is that he said, what did they want? And they asked him what they wanted. They wanted sidurim.
So it's, you know,
not food, not all. First thing they wanted, please bring me a sidur. And he had to start bringing sidurim.
So it's interesting, you know, there are different responses, religious responses to the Holocaust by victims. Some who came out more religious, saying that the fact that I survived this means there has to be a God. And there were others that said, the fact that this happened means there can't be a God. You know, so it's a question that doesn't have an answer. But these are the kinds of dilemmas and things that we bring up with the kids that are as relevant today as they were then.
Do the kids ask these kind of questions?
Yeah. The kids are smart. They are smart. They are
insightful.
Yeah, they are. They're a lot. We don't give them enough credit. I can tell you every time I come back from a trip, I am blown away by what I thank them in my last speech to them for what they taught me. By the questions that they ask. By them sitting halfway into the night outside their room in the corridor because they started a conversation and they don't want to stop. So it's a very important journey to take, I think, for all human beings. All human beings.
And is that the beginning of the education? I mean, those that are not going to or can't afford to go on this, and also people who are already getting older, the education that you talk about, I mean, I know you're leading the youth, but Are there programs, and I know there are programs which are being put forward for older people, and is the education part of, is there a program, or is it as it comes up? I know you had one from with Madeleine and Claude a little while ago.
Last Sunday.
Right, and that, you know, unfortunately I couldn't make it, but.
So that wasn't a program, that was a personal story of theirs.
And that seems to be, that seems to be where a lot of information comes out.
Yes, so those are events.
Fills the gap.
Yes, so those are events that we have. I think that a lot of the shuls run courses. I think it's out there if you want to access it.
So Ronnie Mink, worked with me at a time, because I'm very involved in the Genealogical Society of the Johannesburg Geological Society. South African Genealogical Society. And one of the things was we haven't done it for a while now. We'll be starting a program this year to have a monthly meeting where we bring speakers and guests on the topic of genealogy. And of course, you know, the Holocaust is one of the, is interrupts the flow of Jews wherever they were going. So, you know, they look at how did they end up there and where did they end up afterwards. And of course, one of the factors that led to the migration was that period in Europe. I think it's starting again in some way, but, it's interesting that, and you know, the links and how it is. So I'm hoping that we also doing our part to educate people and tell them what it was about and what their roots are. And I do somehow feel, from what I can see, the schools are engaging in that, you know, teaching people where they come from, what they're about. I suppose they can take a DNA test and find that they weren't really Jewish, or they were, you know, they've got different parts of their lives that are not connected, where they thought they were connected, etc. And or maybe finding out that they are Jewish because of they weren't able to, or the family never told them. So that's all part of this whole process. So tell us about really where you're going with education. I want to expand on that. I want to know if the Hebrew Order of David is an organization worldwide, because we have lodges in America, we have lodges in, and I've been to Holocaust places like Yad Vashem in America. And there's England is part of it. Israel, we're very involved there. South Africa, we have our meetings actually where the Holocaust Center is in Durban and in Cape Town. So, and we also built a Holocaust memorial in Port Elizabeth, which is next to the shul.
I think that we also need to be very careful and not only define ourselves by the Holocaust. I think that we are a lot more than a persecuted people.
I think it's very
easy to fall into that trap of, you know, everything is about the Holocaust. It's certainly something that should never be forgotten, and the lessons should be continuously hammered because they are as relevant today as they ever were. But I think that we are a lot more. We're a great people. I mean, if you look at the achievements of Israel, and I think that that is why on something like March of the Living, we insist on going to Israel afterwards. Because I think that your perspective of Israel is completely different once you've seen what happened when there wasn't an Israel. In that form, it can never happen again because of Israel, because of a strong IDF, etc. And when we march, by the way, the IDF march with us, that their commitment to keep Israel strong and safe, and that Israel is a living thing with a hopefully a great future, doing great things. And I think it's important to show the kids that we're not only about persecution, the Spanish Inquisition and the Holocaust and one thing after another. We are a living people, a thriving people, and to show the world that we are going nowhere.
So in the last few minutes, we only have a few minutes, and you thought we wouldn't be able to fill an hour. And so I'm just going to say a few things about the Hebrew Order of David. Then I want to ask you one or two last questions before we go. So on the 18th of March, the Hebrew Order of David is having a bingo evening. We raised money this year. And for the last couple of years, we've been helping Kosher Mobile Meals to deliver to those in need. And please, 18th of March, we need bums on seats. If that's an expression I can use on here, well, it's a bit late for that now. And it's 200 Rand per person. You get five games. We've got extra games. Come and spend your money. It goes to a good cause. And then in a week's time, on the 11th of February, Rabbi Daniel Brody will be in South Africa. He wrote the book, How to Learn Shabbos in 3 Minutes a Day. And he's coming here. He's going to be on the air next week. He's also going to be on the 11th of February at the HOD Center in the evening. At the center, he'll come into the hall there, and we're going to talk about Shabbos, and we're going to talk about, he's just come back from Daf HaYomi, and he's going to talk about that, and he'll sign books, and he'll sell his books, and bring your money, bring your checkbook, we take credit cards, and we want to raise money. It's a fundraiser, but it's also fun. Talk about, and this is one of the ways in which we work against anti-Semitism. Let's teach people about the religion, etc. So in the last minute that we have left, Rene Pozniak, tell us about your Rene Pozniak and who you are, what you are, a little bit deeper than what we've been talking about.
Well, my most
and where are we going?
My what's most your, important thing is I'm
what's
a mom,
your dream?
A mom of 3 great kids and 5 fantastic grandsons.
Absolutely.
And a wife.
That's the reward in life.
Absolutely.
Grandsons. And where are we going? What's the next stage in your life? You've been a teacher, you're now with the Holocaust. Not going to retire.
No. I think making, I'm very into Jewish identity in whatever form that takes. There's no prescription that you need to be religious or not religious. Be a Jew. Simply be a Jew. As Ronald Lauder said, he's come as a simple Jew. He's not a liberator. He's not a victim. He's not a perpetrator. He's just a simple Jew who cares. And the challenge is to make our generation care. And make them understand the value of keeping this going, this unbelievable legacy that we have. And that's really my focus.
Yes, and Dr. Natalie Solomon, who helps me in every which way, getting this show on the go, and we talk regularly, and she press gangs the, because she's much tougher than I am. She can talk to people to come on the show that I could never imagine. And thank you for coming, Natalie.
Thank you. Kapp,
thanks for your help, Rene. It's been an absolute pleasure. I know it's a hard subject to talk about, but we have to talk about it. And I think what you're doing is wonderful. Tali Nates, the Holocaust Center, you, and everything about it is the way forward. Wherever the Hebrew Order of David can help, we want to be there.
Thank you
for coming on.
Thank you very
Wish
much.
Wish everybody a good Shabbos. Yeah. Tabu, thanks for pressing the buttons. It's 7 o'clock, Johannesburg. Hope it stopped raining. You can drive home safely.
Thank
good
you.
Night.